Dag the Grinch, August Half Faulty Rolf. Hello and welcome. My name is John O'Sullivan, I go by Anshgaley Bjug, and this is a presentation today from the Irish Pagan School on the taking of Ireland. So it's going to be an exploration of the ancient lore that we have with speaking around the return to Ireland of the Tuatha Dé Danann and the sons of Mill or the Milesians, and how the return of these influx of people altered the demographic and the landscape around them. And then kind of bringing a bit of a comparative between the two methods and their two approaches to it, and how that may kind of give us an indication for like what it really means to us, how we can kind of take that information and make it part of our own awareness of our own integrations. So that's the intent of today. It is kind of like story driven. You know, I'm a big fan of stories. My, you know, natural process around that is to talk through stories, but it's what we can learn from those stories that we can go forward. So I've got a couple different sections. We're going to take about 15 minutes or so for each section, after which we're going to take a couple of minutes, maybe engage with the chat, kind of like keep you guys kind of see how we're going, see how we're experiencing things. But I will leave ample time at the end for a bit of Q&A as well. And if people want to pop on for video or audio at that point, we can go from there. Okay. So I'm just going to pop here to go through and share my screen. So I'm going to share this screen here. And now we should have our presentation. So here we go. And this bar is now in my way, so let's pull that down there. Here we go. And present. Where's my present button gone? There we go. Okay. Just gonna make sure I have everything open and we are ready to rock on. Okay, so thank you very much for joining us. As I said, this is about the taking of Ireland, and really it's looking at it from the point of view of information around, like, is it invasions? Like, you know, the topic, the book that we're gonna be working from is known as Lara Gabala Éireann, which is two different translations or multiple different translations. It's the Book of the Taking of Ireland, or otherwise referred to as the Book of Invasions. Okay, so what we're dealing with here is an idea around, is it homecoming or is it kind of something else? So the overview for today's presentation, we're going to go through and give you a bit of an idea of, you know, me as a presenter and kind of where I'm coming from with my exploration of this. Then we're going to look at the order of the invasion. So what does the actual stories and the lore tell us about these returns, these various returns to Ireland and the impact it's had on the land? We're then going to dive in specifically to the Tuatha Dé Danann and then follow on with the Sons of Mill, which was the return following them and the power exchange that occurred in both of those circumstances. We're then going to look at how their interactions compare. Is it descendants returning home, or are we dealing with colonizers coming in to take over? And then the last section, as I said, will be to explore really what it means to ourselves, to kind of take on board some of the information that we have and kind of say, okay, well, what questions should we be asking ourselves? The process in all of these stories is like a bardic knowledge, bardic tool. So any of these stories that's been passed on, there's always the moral of the story. There's always a lesson, you know, and referred to as the Imrama or the Octri. They're like the teaching tales of ancient Irish tradition. And so that's kind of what we're diving into here. All right. So first things first, about me, who am I? There's many different things that I suppose I could be, and I'm trying to find myself very, very carefully with these, but, you know, hopefully these photographs are giving you some kind of image about it. I'm a writer and a storyteller, and if anyone may or may not be aware, I've published the first book recently enough. So Tales of a Dag the Bard, Volume 1 is now out and available. And it's kind of my exploration of my links in with my patron deity on Dagda Mór, the big Dagda, who is a very formative and very kind of integral part of the Tuatha Dé Danann from a chieftain kind of role. But that's not exactly the topic of the story today, but as ever, his influence will be felt because there is impact from him within the stories we're going to deal with. So I'm a writer, I'm a storyteller, I'm a presenter, as I am right now, and an events host. So I kind of integrate with other people and kind of support their events as much as I can, kind of run in as the master ceremonies, because I have no shame and will talk. But it's also kind of bringing people through and kind of, like, you know, working a room to make sure that everyone's on board and hopefully comfortable, and that really when people find that comfortable space, that's where true exchange of wisdom and knowledge can happen. My other roles in the occupation is tour guide and Bard Throne Usurper. It's the image in the bottom right there is a picture of myself sitting on a lovely wooden carved throne which sits out at Loch Crew, out by the visitor center there. It's a fantastic plan of place to experience in Ireland. But I dibs, I call it. It's very, very comfortable for my butt, and that's my chair now. I'm sure everyone else is going to claim it as well. I have no actual legal claims to the chair, but it's a good term. One thing that I always kind of work to, which is just a personal quote on that, it's not always easy to find the words. But when you find the right ones, you can change hearts and minds. And that is kind of my personal motto. You know, I acknowledge that communication can be very, very tricky. Like, you know, detailed and engaging communication can be a challenge. But when you get the right communication, the world can change. Like, you know, I was talking to someone recently enough, and they expressed a view. They'd heard a sad story from someone that they worked with, and they're like, wow, it really knocked me, you know, to hear that, like, you know, I didn't feel so bad with my stuff because they had it worse. And it really brings home that the idea, the gift of perspective, is hugely, hugely important, and of great value. So being able to kind of borrow someone else's eyes for a few minutes, let, you know, live through someone else's perspective, there's a huge amount that we can learn through that. And that to me is the right words. So as ever, bit of a notice that I always give. So a matter of bias and perspective. You know, everyone has a bias and everyone has a perspective. You know, everyone has their own privilege and their own experiences and their own view on reality. You know, the only kind of responsible thing to do as any individual is to acknowledge that. Straight out and say, listen, you know, I have my biases, 100%. But I'll always kind of openly acknowledge other people's perspective. Try and kind of leave as much gap for open question and curiosity to kind of value other people's perspective and manage my own filters as much as possible. Couple of images here in our presentation, like, you know, a caution warning sign, beware of the god. I am a Dagda guy. You know, it's a relationship that I've been working with for a number of years, and it's something that does have formative influences around my day-to-day. I'm right beside me here is a cauldron set up, and, you know, it's not exactly the three best portions of my meal, but it's a cupcake and some mashed potato that he has for today. But again, it's offerings and sharing as much as I can. So a lot of the stuff that we have to go through, I'm going to be quoting directly from a number of the literary sources. I've written them down here. So Lara Gabala Aaron is, of course, the main part, the Book of Taking of Ireland, Book of Invasions. The segments within that is the area focusing on the Milesians and then focusing on the two of the Danann. But there's also a number of other sources from the Battle of Moytura, which is the first Battle of Moytura fought between the Fir Bolg and the two of the Danann when they returned. Then also some more information from specifically around the two of the Danann, and quoting my sources, always very important. AncientText.org and also the UCC Celt Project, which is University College Cork and their collective works of kind of Irish encyclopedia and knowledge and data. So it's not always going to be exactly what everyone kind of goes to. Everyone has their own kind of process, but these are the sources that we have for our presentation today. So section one, you know, the Book of Invasions, the order of the invasions. So if we're going to talk specifically around the return of the two of the Danann and then the return of the sons of Mil or the Milesians who came after them, we need to know the state of play in Ireland to set the scene, as it were. So in any kind of good story, you know, we have to set the scene as to where, what's going on and where are we. So that's what we're going to have a look at here. We're going to have a quick look at, you know, what was the order, like, you know, in what sequence does this story, does this kind of shaping of Ireland happen? And where are we for the return of the Tuatha Dé Danann? Okay, so I mentioned the sources. Lara Gabála Éireann is the Book of Invasions, or the Book of Taking of Ireland. It's one of the oldest written records of Ireland's ancient past. Now, there's multiple versions of it. It was recorded by Irish kind of monks, the early Irish kind of scholars, to take down, in, I think it was around the 11th century, is some of the oldest ones we have, but they do make reference to older manuscripts from the 800s, 900s. And all of these kind of, as I said, Ireland was an oral tradition, was an oral kind of world, because you didn't really want to write the information down. There wasn't a lot of kind of education around written language, but also the culture was around storytelling. It was about, like, you know, gathering together, sitting around a hearth, sharing kind of space and telling those other stories to each other, you know, experiencing these things together as a very formative influence on community. So when we kind of move into the latter generations, a lot of the kind of older stories again may have been moving towards being lost, but the kind of early Christians in Ireland did manage to write them down. So we have the Book of Leinster, the Book of Fermoy, and the Yellow Book of Lecan are some of the oldest manuscripts which have a version of the Lara Gabála Éireann in them. And it's from kind of those informations collated together that we build the overall picture. So I read something somewhere recently, because I do a lot of reading around this, and someone referred to the Tuatha Dé Danann as the first people of Ireland. That's wrong. The records show that there were multiple different returns to the island, and there was people on the island beforehand. So there was the Caesarians, the Partholonians, and the Numidians beforehand. Now, the Christianization of these stories meant that they wanted to fit it within the structure and timeline of their folklore and their kind of theology, really. You know, so the Caesarians and Partholonians kind of existed before the flood. And in fact, it was the Great Flood, Noah's Ark flood thing, that actually wiped out the Partholonians in Ireland. I think there was only a couple of them actually survived. And then from there, it was the Numidians who came back first into Ireland. Now, there's not a lot of information around those specifically, but we do kind of pick up from the Numidians around the challenges that the people experienced there. So at that point, the island of Ireland was deemed to be under oppression by another people. It's known as the Fomorians or the Fomorga. And these individuals kind of obviously had some kind of rights, land ownership. Maybe there's some talk of them being like a pirate culture or raiders. But the people in Ireland, the Numidians, were tithed to the Fomorians in that they had to kind of give a portion of everything. Like, you know, I think it was nearly like 2/3 of anything produced on the island had to be sent to the Fomorian overlords. And so the people went to their sage, a guy called Fintan at the time, and they said, Fintan, you know, what do we do? And I'm going to paraphrase from my reading here. His response was, lads, just get the fuck out. You know, there's absolutely nothing you can do. And so these Numidians kind of gathered their peoples, and they spread, they emigrated out of Ireland. And so the very first stories that we have of Ireland are about emigration. It's about the people and the populace within the country needing to flee from oppression and go outside of the island. So the Numidians go out of Ireland, and then all across the world they settle, and they populate and they grow. And then they face various challenges out there. So from the Numidians, we have the Fir Bolg. And then after that is the return of the Tuatha Dé Danann and the Milesians. So the Fir Bolg are the first to come back after the Numidians, then the Tuatha Dé Danann, then the Sons of Mill. We're going to go a little bit further into that, so I will move on. The Milesians is actually the last return. And they're supposed to be linked with the ancient Gaels, which is the people that humanity in Ireland is essentially descended from. Okay, so we're going to take a look specifically at the latter arrivals. We're going to have some information around the Fir Bolg, again, set the scene, and then we're going to move into the purpose of the presentation, the Tuatha Dé Danann and the Milesians. Okay, so the records show that the Fir Bolg kind of left from Ireland, and they traveled then around the Mediterranean, and it specifically says in the stories that they made it as far as Greece. And this kind of group, this tribe out of Ireland, arrived, up, rocked up in Greece and arrived. And what it says here from the texts, oh, sorry, just about this, a lot of the translations, they're in ancient Irish, you know, so it's not current Irish because we lost our language a long time ago because of colonialism. And we're still kind of trying to get back to that. But a lot of the information that we have is translated from various sources. So we need to kind of go forward with what we have and the best we have. And as much as people do their best to kind of bring that information together and to kind of give us a better picture, it's always going to be a reconstructed picture as best we can offer. So no one's going to ever have it 100% right, but that's kind of what we're working with. So this translation here is from McAllister of the Taking of Ireland, and it says slavery was imposed upon them by the Greeks, the Fribolic. They had to carry clay upon rough mountains so that they became flowery plains. Thereafter, they were weary of the servitude, and they went in flight. Thereafter, they came again into Ireland, the land of their origin. So this kind of speaks to what happened to the Fribolic when they were out of Ireland. So they would rock up to Greece and they're like, okay, well, can we find, have a place to stay? And the Greeks are like, yeah, okay, there you go, up into the worst stretch of land. But the lads, the Fribolic, the people got to work. You know, they got straight into doing what they could to alter their circumstance, to kind of shape the land, to work the land, to improve on it. And they did. They carried the clay up into the mountains and they made it flowery plains. Like, you know, they adjusted and altered the land so it would support them. And then the Greeks realized that they had altered the segment of land that was given to them. And this new area, which was mountainous and could not support habitation, was very, very prosperous. And so the Greeks came and they said, listen, sorry, we're going to have to give you different land. And so they took the land back from them and shifted them off into another mountainous area. And again, the Fribolic got to work, stuck to it, and built a better place. They shaped the land around them again. And the Greeks came again and shuffled them on. So it happened, I think, three times, according to the stories, at which point the Fribolic are like, okay, well, we've had enough of this. Now, it's years, the people, the small tribe who had it turned up had propagated, and there's like a large number of them at this point. And so they decide, okay, well, we need to get out, you know. But of course, these are the descendants of people who had fled from oppression. They ended up in a state of oppression, but they didn't lose their stories. They didn't lose the thing that connected them back to their homeland, the land of their origin, which is Ireland. And so they up and leave. They take down their bags, which is what apparently they were shifting all the clay with and made them into boats. And then they left to go find Ireland again. So they return into Ireland. They find it, you know, unoccupied pretty much. There's no story of any conflict there. And they take over Ireland. And then they rule. They rule happily. They're very comfortable in the land. But years later, there's like a king, a guy called Uki, is ruling from Tara. And this kind of sets our scene for the return of the Tuatha Dé Danann, because Uki has a vision and he has this dream. So I'm going to read this out to you, because he wakes up and he's bothered by this. And he calls together his druid. He's like, you know, okay, I need my chief druid here. We need to have a look at what's going on. And he tells him, I saw a great flock of black birds, said the king, coming from the depths of the ocean. They settled over all of us and fought with the people of Ireland. They brought confusion on us and destroyed us. One of us, methought, struck the noblest of the birds and cut off one of its wings. And now, Sizard, employ your skill and knowledge and tell us the meaning of the vision. So Kazard the druid is kind of set to task, really. He's given us information, and it says that by means of ritual and the use of his sciences, the meanings of the king's vision was revealed to him. So he comes back to the king and he said, I have tidings for you. Warriors are coming across the sea, 1,000 heroes covering the ocean. Speckled ships will press in upon us. All kinds of death, they announce. A people skilled in every art. A magic spell, an evil spirit will come upon you. Signs to lead you astray. They will be victorious in every stress. That, said Uchid, is a prophecy to the coming of Ireland of enemies from far distant countries. Okay, so this is Fraser's translation from the First Battle of Moytura. Okay, so it does set our scene. So this is the kind of backdrop into which we're going to be moving on to the arrival of the Tuatha Dé Danann. So just a couple of takeaway points before we finish up this section. We're looking at the descendants of Nemeth, as I said. These were one people. These were like an initial people who, you know, were forced out of Ireland. They emigrated to escape from Aryan oppression. The tribes are said to have made it to Greece, and there they shaped the rough lands into paradises, only to be moved on again and again by local rulers. So the Fir Bolg, for their efforts, have experienced kind of oppression outside of Ireland, and, you know, in essence, an element of slavery, and been moved on and been unwelcome. To gain escape from that impression, they took their bags and made them into boats to return to Ireland. You know, remembering their culture and their heritage, they wanted to go back to where they came from because they remembered and they valued their origin, the land of their origin. Their return to Ireland was not met with opposition, and they set up their kingdoms and ruled from Tara. But then the last step in summary here is the coming of the Tuatha Dé Danann was foretold. So, you know, the dreams came to the king, and, you know, that they would be these masters of great skill. You know, so this foreboding placed upon them would let them know that there was going to be a lot of change coming forward. Okay, so just going to wrap up section one there, right? Those are the things we need to kind of take on board to set our scene to move into section two, which is the return of the Tuatha Dé Danann. Okay, so I'm going to take a couple quick moments there and just check in how we're doing in the chat. See, Ted has a question there. Hi, Ted. Nice to welcome in. Mentioned the beginning of a returning. I've encountered this before in the works of Michael Sarian, hypothesizing that there was a return from an Irish origin of civilization. Your thoughts on the work and theories. I haven't read that person's works, so I don't know that for sure. I think origin of civilization is a tricky one. And what we do know from a lot of the earlier works is that the roots of the language, and I think for kind of chasing through the existence and tracking origins of a species, the most common way is genetics. But before we had the knowledge of genetics, it was language. So we'd actually trace back the roots of those languages and say, okay, well, you know, where do all of these kind of words come from? You know, this is the value and the importance of words. You know, what are the kind of roots and the influences? So that's where the Indo-European influences really come through in a lot of the languages, which are referred to as Celtic. The whole idea of like Celts are defined by the root kind of connections in their language. So early French, Germanic peoples to a certain degree all have these kind of roots, Irish, Welsh, Scottish, you know, they all kind of come true linguistically. So I don't know, counted four works, hypothesizing that there was a return from an Irish origin of civilization. Again, we're dealing with the ancient story of Ireland, which were passed down orally. A lot of stuff, when you're kind of speaking to someone who's going to write down your stories, you might give them most of the information. There's also going to be cultural differences. So something that's accepted as common knowledge in a certain culture might be hard to pass across when you're dictating a story to someone else who might not be of your culture. So it's hard to say for sure, but you could hypothesize that there's a lot of gaps, you know, and even then when we have latter kind of experts in language coming back through, trying to translate, you know, any kind of alterations or any kind of turns of phrase or colloquialisms might not translate easily into how it changes. And Irish is a very poetic language in a certain way, and a lot of imagery is weaved into the words, you know, and ancient Irish even more so. So it's a tricky thing to kind of dig out. I'm going to kind of hold on to that question as well. I think I will definitely look up that person as well, Michael, and see about enhancing my own knowledge. Thanks very much for that. I do appreciate it, Ted. Okay. Any other questions at this point, or shall we drive on into section two? I'm going to grab a quick sip of my tea. Okay. Rightio. Okay. Going to drive on into section two here, and this is where we're going to talk about the big show as it is, the Tour de Danann. It becomes very easy to see why the Tour de Danann are so popular and referred to so strongly as the ancient gods of Ireland, the ancient heroes. Because even like, you know, from the Forboding Foreboding, they were prophesied as being the best at everything. You know, now I'm someone who always values a question. You know, personally, I will go out of my way for questions, and I really, really love getting questions that I can kind of get my teeth into and figure out. If someone comes to me and tells me they have all the answers, I'd be like, good for them. If you say I have a question, I'll give you all the time in the world. Because that to me is that connection, that interplay of exchange of perspective, and kind of you learn more from questions. So I always question, like, you know, why do we not worship Fir Bollaig? You know, why is there not more of a Milesian influence in our deities? And what is it about the Tuatha Dé Danann that really kind of takes us in that way? And I think hopefully we can explore a little bit of that. Maybe it's a whole other presentation. But what we're going to talk about now is their return. So specifically, we've set up where Ireland is under the rulership of the Fir Bollaig. You know, these people who've kind of had it rough, you know, and finally come home and finally had their own say upon their land, their right to rule themselves in their own land. And now we have this worry about the Tuatha Dé Danann coming and taking Ireland. So again, I've got a couple of different kind of quotes here, all right, from the text. I'm going to read through them. And then once we get to the end of the section, we'll maybe have a bit of a chat around what they're telling us, okay? So from the stories, again, Lairgabála Éireann and the First Battle of Moytura, we have this kind of quote here. As for the Tuatha Dé Danann, they all arrived in Ireland and immediately broke and burnt all their ships and boats. And at last, their hearts and minds were filled with contentment, for they had attained the land of their ancestors. So the Tuatha Dé Danann are another group of descendants from the Numidians, right? So they are the sons of Numid who'd left out of Ireland because of the Fomorian oppression. And much like the Fir Bollaig, they had kept their ancient kind of connection to their origin, to their land, to where they came from. You know, Ireland to them was still very important. And so when, you know, the Fomorians placed oppression on them where they were, because the Tuatha Dé Danann come from four major cities that we know of, they were still tithed by the Fomorians. So they decided to kind of get out from where they were, but come back to where they came from. And this translation here says that they broke their ships and burnt them. And then that caused a great kind of mist or cloud to come up. And that's their explanation. It's a latter explanation from one of the other translations of the Battle of Moytura and the story about the Tuatha Dé Danann, because one of the other stories, again, as I said, there's multiple versions of this tale. One says that they just arrived in a mist, you know, that they came from the sky. And that's where the mysticism elements really become strong with the Tuatha Dé Danann, because they arrive on these sky ships out of the sky, out of the mists. And in Irish tradition and Irish folklore, the travel over into the mists is a barrier, a liminal space to enter the other world or on Sailala. So it does have a pretty important thing there. Okay. So I beg your pardon, terribly sorry for that. So the next section is the Tuatha Dé Danann saw a huge and fearsome man approaching. Okay, so yeah, what happens there is the Tuatha Dé Danann arrive back in Ireland. And the first thing they do is to kind of say, okay, well, we're not leaving. We have come home. You know, that line filled with contentment for having contained, like, attained the land of their ancestors. They have returned and they're not leaving. Like, their intent is, I'm sorry, this is home. We have to come back here. All right. So Uchid knows that there's this return happening. So he sends out one of his main warriors, one of his champions, to go and assess these threat, these thousand heroes. And so this is our first interaction, our first kind of connection between these two peoples. And it's done individually, person to person, between two heroes. So the Tuatha Dé Danann saw a huge fearsome man approaching them. Then Bresh, son of Alatha, went out from the camp to inspect him and parley with him. And this is Shreng. So this is like the champion, the best of the best, really, for the Fir Bollaig, because you're going to put your best foot forward. And Shreng comes out. The next part I really, really thought was important when looking at this story. Then they greeted each other, for they spoke the same language, their origin being the same. and explain to each other as follows who they were and who their ancestors were. So this was a big part because in all of the ancient stories, there's the elements in the culture of the bards, right? And one of the biggest, most important roles of the bards is to remember the names and the places of things. And the names and the places of things invariably come from who it was that discovered it or who they're descended from and who lives in that area. So what we have here is the image of Shreng, this main champion of the Firbolg, meeting Bresh, this champion of the Tuatha De Danann, and they're standing and they're described like for like. You know, described as two, you know, people of equal stature, like, you know, two very big, very physical warriors who inspect each other, but they don't jump straight to blades. Like they approach each other and they are cautious. It says that, like, you know, Shreng kind of keeps a shield in front of them and like they're standing there kind of having a conversation, but the root language is the same. You know, they're able to communicate, and you can, to me, it's that kind of, I am Bresh, son of Alata, I am Shreng of the Firbolg, and they explain who they are, they explain who they're descended from, and it comes to them that they're both of the same people. So we have an extra, like, they have this full-on back and forward, and they get on well. This first interaction between the two people, between these two representatives of their people, is a very pleasant one, and they share knowledge of each other. But then they take it one step further, because Bresh is like, okay, well, listen, we need to kind of have land here. We need to kind of come home. This is our home. You're of Sons of Nemed. We're Sons of Nemeds. We're of the same people. We just need to share in this. Can we, you know, have a section of the land? And Shreng is like, not really sure. Let's see how we go. And this is the quote that we have. It's like, go then, said Bresh. And here is one of the two spears I brought with me. Take it as a specimen of the weapons of the Tuatha. Shreng gave one of his javelins to Bresh as a specimen of the weapons of the Firbolg. Tell the Firbolg, said Bresh, that they must give my people either battle or half of Ireland. On my word, said Shreng, I should prefer to give you half of Ireland than face your weapons. They parted in peace after making a compact of friendship with each other. So, the first interaction that we have between these two disparate tribes is, hi, who are you? Who are you descended from? Who's your dad? Like, you know, who's your line, grand? And they suss each other out. They check each other out. You know, they look and, you know, there's a segment where Shreng is like, jeez, I don't like the look of those spears. You know, and Bresh is like, spears? What about those javelins? Like, you know, what is that? And they have not just an exchange of language, not just an exchange of kind of who we are. They have an exchange of technology. They share of each other. It's not a threat of like, here, take my spear, you know, to show how good we are at stuff. It's literally, here, have a look. You know, let's be fair in our knowledge of each other. And this first interaction kind of gives us a good insight into the approach of the Tuatha De Danann to coming home. Okay. So Bresh goes back to Nuada, who's currently our king at this time. And he's like, okay, well, you know, I don't know how it's going to go, but, you know, I've set the claim to him. So it was then that Nuada proposed that the Tuatha De Danann sent envoys to the Firbolg. They must surrender half of the island, and we shall divide that land between us. Who will be our envoys? The people asked, and it's our poets who we're going to send. So Bresh comes back, Shreng goes back. They both talk to them, and Nuada straight away is like, okay, it might come to battle, but let's try again. Let's send envoys. Let's make peace. Like, you know, let's try and not have this go to fights. So they send the poets, you know. Again, this is the role within the culture of language, of knowledge, of people, these bards, the envoys who have the ability to kind of translate or transfer knowledge and stories and lineage. And so the poets are actually sent to communicate into Uchad's court, into the Firbolg court. And so the next segment we have in the story is from this. It's actually in the court of the Firbolg in Tara. This is why we are come, said the poets, to request the dividing of the land between us, an equitable halving of Ireland. And so Uchad responds, do the nobles of the Firbolg hear that? We do, replied the nobles, but we shall not grant a request till doomsday. Then said the poets, when do you mean to give us battle? And so it's another attempt to come and have a conversation. You know, we're not looking to take over. We're not looking to dominate. All we're looking for is a fair share, a bit of space to be part of this, you know. But the Firbolg, again, we can't blame the Firbolg. If we remember their origin stories, what they went through, you know, they finally come back to Ireland. They have the right to self-rule within their own land. And then more people kind of generations later, maybe years later, they then looking at, okay, well, you know, you're going to try and take something that we fought so hard to kind of get back. So it doesn't go straight to battle, though. You know, it doesn't go straight into, okay, well, I'll meet you tomorrow. No, the next thing is, well, some delay is called for we shall have to prepare our spears and mend our mail, to shape our helmets, to sharpen our swords, and to make suitable attire. There were brought to them men to arrange those things. Provide, they said, shields for a tenth, swords for a fifth, a spears for a third part. You must furnish each with what we require on either side. We, said the envoys of the two of the Dan and to the Firbolg, shall have to make our spears. And you must make our javelins. The two of the Danann were then given the hospitality till that was done. So they arranged an armistice till the weapons arrived, till their equipment was ready, and they were prepared for battle. The Druids went back to the two of the Danann and told their story from beginning to end of how the Firbolg would not share the land with them and refused in favor or friendship. The news filled the two of the Danann with consternation. Okay? The reason why I pulled in that particular segment is it doesn't go straight into Blade's battle and murder. They agree a commonality of purpose and cause. They agree an armistice to say, okay, well, you know, if we're going to have a fight, we want it to be a fair and even balanced fight. We need to have enough shields, enough swords. But again, the Firbolg don't have spears. And the two of the Danann don't have javelins. And so the two of the Danann say, okay, well, we'll make your spears for you if you make javelins for us. So the exchange of technology, the exchange of knowledge and ability is there. Like, you know, it's not a case of, well, I've got a superior technical advantage in war, so I'm going to hold on to that and just take it, like, and use that to win. No, this idea of combat is based on an equitable understanding. It's based on a fair sharing to make it an honest competition. So there was a particular line in that particular word, which, again, I'm a didactic guy. Someone mentions the word hospitality, I'm always going to jump on that because of its importance. Being able to kind of, the two of the Danann were then given hospitality till it was done. Hospitality means you live in my house, I feed you food, you are my friend, you are protected by me, you are pretty much as kin to me in a lot of circumstances. And so this early culture, the Firbolg, as much as the two of the Danann, valued and respected hospitality is very, very formative to establishing society. If it wasn't for the fact that you would have this kind of fundamental baseline, someone turns up at your home, someone is protected, and they have the right to request. It's not, asylum. But it kind of has some of those connotations in there as well. You know, if you come to my home, I'll protect you and I'll look after you as long as you're a decent guest and you don't kind of break the rules around hospitality that way. So there is this sharing, but the last line there, the Druids go back, and this is where it changes from poets to Druids. You know, again, the knowledge and the power of language, being able to control and manipulate the power of the elemental forces in the world, is what makes poets and Druids kind of almost synonymous one to the other. And so the wise people, like the people who had all the experiences, were sent, but there were also people who had power who were sent. And so they come back, they tell the two of them and Nuada, like, okay, well, it's not going to go, we're going to have a fight, but here's the agreement. You know, they set a day. They say, okay, well, we need all this time and we'll meet you, you know, a couple of months from now on this particular plane, and that's where we'll have our fight, you know. But the two of the Danann were filled with consternation. They were not happy that it was going to go to a battle. And so the overtures of peace become arrangements for battle. But even here, there's a lot to be taking from that and the manner in which they go about it, the intent behind it, to say, okay, well, if we're going to go to battle, let's make sure it's balanced. You know, let's make sure we're both on the same page here. Okay? So we then move into the battle itself. The Battle of Moytura. So as I said, they met in a particular location, they agreed it, and they set up. And so we're going to have a quick look at a couple of snippets from the battle. Now, there was a whole load of information here. There's talks of like the heroic deeds of, like, you know, certain champions, like Shrang makes his kind of position felt all over the place. But there's a long list of, okay, well, these people went out on this day, these people went out on that day, these are the champions that did this. But what it really kind of wanted to pull through here is some notable things about the manner in which the battle was held. So the days kind of happen, and there's the day of conflict, but the wars themselves, the battles between them, are not held to the point of eradication. It's not a constant siege. It's not a constant kind of like one against the other. It's a day of fighting, after which there is an evening of rest. And so it says here, by the close of the day, the two of the Danann were defeated. This was on the first day, and returned to their camp. The Firbolg did not pursue them across the battlefield, but returned in good spirits to their own camp. They each brought with them into the presence of their king a stone and a head, and made a great cairn of them. The two of the Danann set up a stone pillar called the Pillar of Eidlio, after the first of them to be killed. Their physicians then assembled. The Firbolg too had their physicians brought to them. They brought healing herbs with them and crushed and scattered them into the surface of the waters in a well, so that the precious healing waters became thick and green. The wounded were put into the well and immediately came out whole. So this is really important because for me, again, it's all really important, and I apologize if I come across as repeating myself, but it's not, as I said, a battle of eradication, you know? They allow each other the space to tend to their wounded. And it does show here that both the Firbolg and the two of the Danann have this skill, have this knowledge in healing, to make these healing wells, to put their warriors in, the wounded, and restore them to full health. And so that means they're able to carry on and pursue this battle. But it's battle on these fair and even terms. And so we have our first day. The two of the Danann lose. They lose the first day straight up. The Firbolg give them the space to kind of get themselves sorted for the next day. So there's an honor in their interactions with each other here. So the next day comes around, and when night fell, the Firbolg were driven across the battlefield. However, they each brought a head and a stone to Uchid, their king. "Is it you that have been beaten today?" said the king. "Yes," said Kirb, "but that will not profit them." Okay, so there is talk of the losses, like the harm both sides are losing. If someone's wounded, they can be restored. If someone's killed, or, you know, if their head is taken, there isn't much coming back from that. But again, it's that kind of, yeah, we lost, but we are not pursued out of it. And Kirb is like, okay, well, their spirit is not broken. And that's the last part. It won't profit them. We lost the day, but it's not over. You know, so Kirb, this hero, kind of was leading out the battle, and later on in the story, it's Kirb fell before the Dagda, spattering blows. Again, as I said, I'm a Dagda guy, he is going to pop up in my stories, and this kind of shows that Dagda was there. This kind of chieftain was involved in the battles. There's another part in the story where Dagda leads the left flank and crashes through, opening a gap for 150 warriors to follow him. At the same time, Shreng, our hero from the start of the story, breaks the two of the Danann lines and opens a gap for 150 warriors. So we know that Dagda is this very powerful, very, very big figure in the two of the Danann, but we have Shreng doing the same feats, doing the same things here. So it shows that there's heroes on both sides, heroes of great ability. But after the fall of Kirb, the Firbolg were driven into their camp. The two of the Danann did not pursue them across the battlefield, but they took with them a head and a stone pillar apiece, including the head of Kirb, which was buried in the cairn of Kirb's head. So it shows that as the battle kind of goes on, the two of the Danann are respecting the same flow of combat. They're allowing the Firbolg to withdraw, to return, and to give themselves the time to heal. But also the last part there, they buried Kirb's head. They took this champion, they acknowledged him as value, and they made a cairn for him. They didn't kind of put on a pike and display it. There's no kind of disrespect to the dead here. You know, everything is kind of brought back, and the stone as much as the head. Like you push it and then you put your stones in it, and that's where all of these cairns, and there's so many cairns all across Ireland which are all named, much like this, the cairn of Kirb's head. And so it's acknowledgement that you may be fighting against an opponent, you may be pursuing a war or a battle, but you're still respecting those who kind of follow. So the battle kind of goes on. There's a lot of, the prophecy is fulfilled in essence. Uchid, the king of the Fir Bolg, has kind of spells and sorceries placed on him. You know, he is then led off and astray, and he loses. Like, you know, he's attacked in various different places, and eventually he's killed. They lose their king. But it doesn't kind of break them. It doesn't end them. So Nuada, in the same point, ends up facing Shrang in battle, and Nuada has his hand cut off, or his arm. And so that's where, you know, it's Moitura part one, the homecoming, that Nuada loses his arm and then he's no longer fit form to be king. But the loss of Uchid, their king, doesn't kind of break them, doesn't break the Fir Bolg. So they have a war council, they gather together after Uchid is lost, and they consider what is in their interest to do, whether they should leave Ireland or offer a regular battle or undertake to share the land of the Tuatha Dé. They decided to offer the Tuatha Dé battle. And Shrang said this: "Resistance is destruction for men. We resolutely gave battle. There was clashing of hard swords and strong plying of spears on the sides of noble warriors, and the breaking of buckler on shield. Full of trouble are the plains of Ireland. Disaster we found about its woods, and the loss of many good men." So Shrang at the very start, who met with Bresh, kind of went home in friendship from meeting Bresh and said to Uchid, "I don't really think we can beat these guys in a fight." They end up going to battle anyway, and Shrang does his duty. And when Uchid dies, still the nobles of the Fir Bolg are like, "Okay, well, no, we're not gonna run away. We're not gonna leave Ireland, because they've done that before. We're not gonna give up land, because again, we've been in that position before, unfortunately." So they're holding that, and it's like, "No, we're gonna fight. We're gonna fight to the very end." And that's where Shrang, like, you know, his words here kind of speak to me of a bit more counsel around, like, you know, "Listen, we've done a good fight here. Now, every person has actually put the fight in, put the effort in, but it's disaster and destruction that we're facing here. Like, we've lost many good men." But they go out. So they settle themselves out, and the Fir Bolg decide, "Okay, well, if we're going to last stand, we're going to last stand hard." And it was there then that Shrang called challenge to single combat with Nuada, as they had fought in the previous battle. So Shrang has already cut off Nuada's arm. Nuada is one-armed at this point, but he's been restored by Dean Kecht, the healer within the Tuatha Dé, but he's still missing his arm. And so he calls him out again. Shrang is like, "Okay, well, you know, if we're going to go out, I'll challenge single combat, and let's resolve it that way." And Nuada faced him bravely and boldly, as if he had been whole, and said, "If single combat on fair terms is what you seek, fasten your right hand, as I have lost mine. Only so can our combat be fair." Shrang responds, "If you have lost your hand, that lays me under no obligations," said Shrang, "for our first combat was on fair terms. We ourselves so took up the quarrel." So again, even in the midst of all these battles, there's still this drive to be fair, to be equal, to be balanced. Like, if you want a fair fight, let's make it a fair fight. And Nuada's kind of asking for Shrang to bind himself because, again, Nuada's lost his arm. But Shrang's like, "Okay, well, that actually wouldn't be fair, because it's not on me that you lost your arm the first time around, you know? So we don't really want the fight here. You know, we took up the quarrel, but, you know, if this is the way it's got to go." And so Shrang doesn't back down from it. And so the two of the Danann then take a moment. They take themselves aside and have counsel. And their decision was to offer Shrang his choice of the provinces of Ireland, while a compact of peace, goodwill, and friendship should be made between the two people. So the Fir Bolg kind of step away. They know they're coming to the end of their strength. They say, "No, we're not going to give it. We're gonna go out all the way." You know, Shrang is like, "Listen, we may all die here. You know, resistance is destruction of men." But he follows with them. He's like, "Okay, well, I'll offer them single combat, and we'll stand our ground. We're not giving up." And at that point, it's the two of the Danann who are like, "Okay, well, listen, these lads aren't backing down. So maybe we should back down." You know, at this point, they know they can win. The strength of the Fir Bolg has been broken. They don't eradicate them. they offer them and say, listen, actually, you pick your province, pick where you want to be, pick the land, you know, and let's be friends here, and let's be shared between them as friendship amongst our two peoples. And so the Battle of Moytura Part 1 comes to an end, not with an absolute destruction, but with the Firbolg not backing down and being acknowledged with respect and with honor by the two of the Danann, who are like, okay, well, let's live together. I'd rather live with you than destroy you. And so our takeaway points, just in summary on this segment, I know there's a lot of text here, so we are going through it. I am kind of trying to keep an eye on time, but not rush it too much. Again, we can go over time because we're running the show here today ourselves. So it's whatever you guys need. But our takeaway points. So the two of the Danann are descendants of Nemed, who had left the island and they returned to the land of their ancestors. So again, it's that coming home. They, finding it occupied, request a share of the land for the tribe. So their first action is, can we have a segment to live in? Can we kind of meet half and half? You know, the first interaction between the two tribes is a champion to champion. It's an acknowledgement of shared language and shared bloodline. You know, they're saying, okay, we're of the same people. You know, we come from the same source. So, you know, we might be different. We might have kind of, you know, it's our ancestors who are of the same blood, same Namibians, but like, it doesn't make us different when we get to the point of like, you know, we're all the same essentially. But they agreed times to avoid the battle. Their first communication is, listen, we don't want to have a fight here. If we can get some land, a space to live, then we won't have a fight. And on more than one occasion, like, you know, Nuada, the king, sends the druids and the poets over to have a conversation, to offer a dialogue. Can we just avoid a battle? Can we have a place to live? Can we split this down the middle and be fair and be equitable? You know, the Firbolg don't disagree with them, but they offer their battle. But again, it's battle on agreed terms. So it's this kind of sharing, this middle ground of, okay, well, you know, you have spears, we have javelins. Let's exchange this information. Let's exchange the technology so that no one has a specific advantage that makes them better. So that when it comes to the battle, it won't be based on who has a longer spear or who has longer range. It's going to be based on who is the better. Like, you know, it's down to skill. It's not down to a technical trick. It's down to, like, you know, the ability to face each other evenly and fight fair and honestly. So they do pursue the battle. It's days and days, like there's multiple days worth of battle. But every single day, it's not a battle to eradicate each other. It's not an extermination. It's an established conflict. It's an agreed place to have fights, to allow yourselves to withdraw, to come back and have a fight, to establish the rulership of Ireland. You know, each of them was given time to cease the conflict and tend to their wounded and bury their dead. But not just their own dead. You know, remember that stone and a skull, stone and a head, they buried the other people's dead as well. You know, they acknowledge, okay, well, they're a hero. You know, they're, you know, of these people as well. So we need to bury them with honor. So in the end, the two of the Danann won. But they didn't kick the Firbolg out. They integrated. They kept them on board. They said, okay, well, let's live together. I'd rather live with you than, you know, fight all the way against you. And so the Firbolg, I think they choose Connacht in the west of Ireland, so the western province. And so the two peoples kind of integrate and live together. All right. So that kind of brings us to the end of our summary on this section. So we're going to take another couple minutes there if people want to fire any questions about that on the Two of the Danann segment before we move on to the Milesians and the Sons of Mil. So does anyone have any questions at that point? I'm willing to accept questions around my pacing as well, just to make sure I'm not running too far ahead or kind of losing people in the talk of it. Thanks, Alistrania. So the pacing is great. Appreciate that. Oh, I have your comment earlier on. Right. So just in a chat there, Alistrania said, like, you're wondering about the return of the two of the Danann, the fact that they came out of the mists, and one translation of the story, as I said, is this kind of mystical element that they are the gods returning to Ireland and that they come from the mists and on these skyships and stuff like that. But a different later translation, I think it's a later translation, kind of demystifies it a little bit and just says that, you know, they know, well, they must have come and burnt their ships, which would cause this cloud and cause these mists across the island. So it was a demystified version, which, see, again, whether or not we're dealing with deity here is something to probably look at the end. But it's that area of, like, you know, do deity just manifest out of, you know, out of the mists? Or is it a case that there's a practical realism around this that leads to how they work within our reality? So that is a pretty deep discussion. But Alastrina kind of mentions there, like, you know, it's a better understanding of their struggles, and are they not aliens from ships? So that kind of History Channel, aliens, it's never aliens until it's aliens. So yeah, there's a lot of kind of different information coming back and forward around it as we kind of move through these translations. But as I said, we're dealing with ancient Irish here, and that's not easy either. Yeah, a popular pagan myth debunked about the aliens, ancient aliens. I don't know. Depends on what you believe on, you know, the scope of life in our galaxy or in our universe. But I think that might be taking us slightly off topic for this discussion. Okay, so if that's that part, we're going to move on to section 3. And we're going to be looking at the Sons of Mil, the Milesians. So if we recall, so the two of the Danann arrived, and after which comes the Milesians, the Sons of Mil. So we're going to look at, again, similar format. We're going to go through the stories. We're going to be pulling out these segments that kind of give us an idea of the manner in which the Sons of Mil, the Milesians, return and the why. So Sons of Mil returned to Ireland for a war of vengeance. So what actually happens is that, as for the Gaedil, or Gaedil, depending which way I'm still working on pronouncing, like, you know, again, my pronunciations are going to be based on my understanding of school Irish, you know, school level Irish that I was taught. And I've never heard these words said out loud, so I'm doing my best with them. But essentially, there's this talk, there is this kind of, again, there's the conversation about what's happening and, you know, where things are. So the Sons of Mil are described as being conquerors throughout their backstory, their origin story. You know, we've given their ventures from La Fete Noire onward, and from the Tower of Nimrod, till we have left them at Brogan's Tower in Spain. And we've referred to related how they took Spain by force. So this is the backstory. This is the origin story of the Sons of Mil. These are conquerors. And they've come from the lower Middle East, and they've kind of worked their way up, and they've conquered here, they've conquered there, they took the Tower of Nimrod, and then they come over, and it finishes with them in Spain, you know, at Brogan's Tower. Okay, so they took it by force, and it's in the tower, on Brogan's Tower, that this guy called Is saw Ireland for the first time. On a winter's evening, from the top of Brogan's Tower, for thus is a man's visions best, on a clear winter evening, Is, with thrice 30 warriors, came to Ireland. So this the conqueror, this kind of one of the Sons of Mil, is up in this really tall tower. And if you're in Spain, and, you know, it's a very clear winter day, you probably would be able to see far out. You'd see, like, the islands further across. I don't know. So where exactly Brogan's Tower is, but obviously he saw Ireland. And then out of curiosity, of course, he's like, oh, well, let's go there and let's have a quick look. So he comes with a war party to Ireland. And this is the first coming. So he arrives, you know, and he like his first experience when he comes is of, we have a description of what Ireland is kind of like from his view. Then said Is, work just righteousness, for good is the land wherein ye dwell. Plenteous is fruit, its honey, its wheat, its fish, moderate its heat and its cold. So he comes into this, and what the story says is that Is kind of arrives in. He kind of comes into the south of Ireland and hops off the boat with his warriors, and they kind of roam around and they kind of rock up the tower, and they're like, hey, yeah, where's the king? And at this point in the story, there are three kings in Ireland, and they're actually grandsons of the Dagda, in fact. And they're like the people in Tara and in the ruling place. No, actually, they're not here. They're off at a cattle judging, so they're off down towards the south, down into Munster. And so Itz goes to find them, and he's kind of walks up and he's talking to him. He's like, "Listen, you, this is a great place. Look at the land in which you dwell, you know." But he then leaves them, like, you know, and of course these three kings have seen this foreign warrior. And they're concerned about him. Like, you know, there's something a little bit kind of worrisome about the manner in which he's interacted with them. And so they have him killed. And so they have him killed, but they don't wipe out his entire party. They're like, okay, well, no, we think he's a spy. We think there's a threat here. So we're going to remove him as a threat. But this is the quote that we have for that. So it was to avenge Ith that the sons of Mil, to wit the Grail Deal, came for his, its body was carried to Spain. So Ith was killed in Ireland, but his body was sent back to Spain. He wasn't kind of just ditched into a bog. He wasn't kind of turfed into the sea. He was returned to his people in Spain. And so the Milesians in Spain kind of receive Ith back, and they're like, whoa, whoa, hold on, what's happened here? We need to go and avenge this. So their response straight away is to address what they see as this problem with a war of vengeance. And so they gather, and I think it says that they gather kind of like there's four sons of Mil, and each of them kind of gathers their ships and gathers their warriors. So like there's a big description of the volume of the horde involved. And so each of them has like 50 ships, and each ship has like, you know, 30 people on it. So there's an army. It's a full-on invading army. But every time the sons of Mil come up to Ireland, the demons would frame the port with a hog's back, whence Ireland is called Hog Island. They skirted around Ireland three times and landed at last in Inverskeen. So Ireland is defended. Ireland defends itself. Like, you know, the magic of the Tuatha Dé Danann is kind of keeping them away. You know, it's actually kind of disguising the land to make it look like it's not safe place, that it's just like a hog's back. Oh, well, no, you can't really land there. It's just a rock the size of a hog's back in the middle of nowhere, you know? So eventually, though, the sons of Mil are like, no, well, obviously something, there is someone here because it came back dead. So we have to keep going. And so it takes them a time to find safe landing, and they do. And the first thing they do is to fight. They invade. So they come in off the ships, and within 3 days, at the end of 3 days and three nights thereafter, the sons of Mil broke the battle of Slieve Mhíth against demons and Formoriga, that is against the Tuatha Dé Danann. So they come straight in. They land on the island. It takes some time to get there, but within 3 days, they've already kind of had battle. They've had battle against everyone that they've come across. There's no dialogue. They're straight into combat. And then this is where we have Emergan. Emergan is their poet. Again, now if you remember, the poets are the people who hold on to knowledge, and they use the power of words to kind of manipulate and control reality, because that was the belief and that was the power. You can control the elements of reality, the whole everything through the power of words. And so Emergan Lungal, which translates as white knee, when he kind of comes up to Ireland, he sets his foot upon Ireland. He kind of speaks this poem. I am wind on sea. I am ocean wave. I am roar of sea. I am bull of seven fights. I am vulture on cliff. But then he kind of, like, the poem goes on. He declares himself as he puts his foot on Ireland. He declares that he is all of these great things. And he kind of carries on. But then he moves into listing what he sees. And again, it's much like Ith's arrival, where he describes what he says. And it's like, you know, Emergan kind of kinship goes into a fishful sea, a fruitful land. And so he takes all his time. And so his first action when he comes to the island, you know, is to declare himself with all these great titles, but then actually move himself into describing everything he sees, all these bounteous, wonderful rivers, these big kind of forests. And straight away, the warriors are in, and it's 3 days later, and they've already had battle with pretty much everyone on the island. That's the Sons of Mil approach. But it doesn't kind of end there for them. What happens next is probably one of the most telling things for the Sons of Mail, in my view, because it deals with the idea of sovereignty. It deals with the idea of the otherworldly mystical nature that is the island of Ireland. And so what happens following, there's going to be three segments that I'm going to go through with you. The Sons of Mill had colloquy with Bamba in Sleave Mish. Said Bamba unto them, if it be to take Ireland ye have come, not right were the good fortune in which ye have come. It is by necessity, said Amargan Glungal, the poet. A gift from you to me then, said she. What gift, said they? That my name may be on this island, said she. What is thy name, said they? Bamba, she said. Let it be the name of the island, said Amargan. So this is his first interaction with Bamba, and she's one of the kind of, the, in essence, it's a goddess, a sovereignty goddess of the land. And their first communication, she's like, listen, it's not good fortune. You're not coming here in the right way. But how about this? I'll give him a gift. Name the island after me. And Amargan is like, yep, yeah, okay, totally do that. Gonna name the island after you. So it's gonna be called after you, Bamba. And so the warriors kind of carry on. And then there's another. They had colloquy with Eru in Uisnech. She said unto them, warriors, said she, welcome to you. Long have soothsayers had knowledge of your coming. Yours shall be this island forever. And to the east of the world there shall be no better island. No race shall there be more numerous than yours. Good is that, said Amargan. Good is the prophecy. So he goes to this other kind of goddess, and she's like, listen, you were always going to come here. We knew that this was going to happen, and it's going to be a great island. So straight up, it's positive points, and Amargan is like, yeah, that's pretty good. But then things take a bit of a twist, because Eber Don is one of the Sons of Mil, one of the leaders of this invasion army. And his response when Eru speaks to him in this way is, not right were it to thank her, said Eber Don, eldest of the Sons of Mil, thank our gods and our own might. And so Eru, this, again, sovereignty goddess within the land, is like, listen, it's going to be yours. Let's just be cool about this. And Eber Don's like, No, we're not going to thank you. We're not going to acknowledge you. We're going to thank our own gods and our own might. It's all about us. It's not about you. So in this twist, he disrespects this offering of the land. And so Eru responds, to thee, 'tis equal, said Eru. Thou shalt have no profit of this island, nor shall thy progeny. A gift to me, ye sons of Mil, and ye children of Brogan, said she, that my name shall be on this island. It shall be its principal name, said Amargan. So Eber Don kind of doesn't go with this interaction with the sovereignty of the land. And she straight up calls him on it. She says, listen, you're not going to have any profit here. Or your children. You know, you're pretty much done as far as we're concerned. But she's back to speaking to Amargan again. And she's like, listen, I'd like the name. The island needs to be named after me. And Amargan's like, yep, we'll totally call it after you. So he has now twice promised, once to Bamba and once to Eru, to name the island in the name of her. And so it comes to this then. The invading army has moved their way across the land. Like, Uisnech is actually in the east of Ireland. It's actually just north of Dublin, north and west a little bit of Dublin. So it's one of the main kind of centers still, actually, and it was in those days. I'm not going to get into too much about it because it's not my area of expertise. I know Laura is in the chat with us, and there's a lot of kind of history and story around Uisnech. It's a place of kind of druidic practice. It's one of the kind of center stones of Ireland. It's one of the kind of locuses of kind of spiritual belief in a lot of ways. I think that might be the safest way to go about it. But yeah, so this army of invaders has been in the country for a long while. And finally they come to the three kings, which is Macuil, Macaigh, and Macraidin. So these, as I said, are the grandsons of the Dagda. And so they kind of come together and they have this conversation, and they pronounce judgment against the Sons of Mil, that they should have the island for 3 days, free from assault, from assembly of battle, or from giving of hostages, for they were assured that they, the invaders, would not return. So essentially, actually, I'll read the paragraph and then I'll break it down. It might be best. Because the druids would make spells behind them so that they should not be able to return. "We shall adjudge it," said Macul. "Kermit, as Amrigan is our own judge, shall pronounce it for you. For if he should give false judgment, he would die at our hands." "Give the judgment, Amrigan," said Eberdon. "I pronounce it," said Amrigan. "Let the island be left to them." "How far shall we go?" said Eber. "Past just 9 waves," said Amrigan. "This is the first judgment given in Ireland." Now, there's a lot of the kind of "this is the first judgment" or "this is the first kind of naming of this," because again, a lot of these traditions were oral stories transferred out. But the interesting thing about this is that the three kings are like, "Okay, well, listen, can we have 3 days? We want 3 days without battles, without assaults, without assemblages, without hostages. We just need 3 days, and then we can kind of sort this out." So the two of the Danann are looking for space, you know, much like their ancestors did when dealing with the Morrigans. Can we just have a bit of gap here? Can we have a ceasefire, an armistice, you know, to arrange things? But having seen the interactions of the Sons of Mil, having seen the fact that they've invaded and that they've kind of conquered the way across the island, the two of the Danann are making a play for the time needed to protect themselves. And so knowing that once the Sons of Mil leave the island, they'll be able to have their druids cast spells behind them to keep them out. You know, they need to just kind of get them off the island. And so they allow, or they kind of give the space so that the Sons of Mil, Amrigan, this person who's been doing all this negotiation with sovereignty goddesses and such, they say, "Okay, well, actually, you choose, you know. How about this? You make your judgment. We're just looking for 3 days. What do you say?" And Eberdon, one of the leaders, is like, "Okay, well, whatever Amrigan says, we'll go with." And Amrigan says, "Okay, well, let's give them the 3 days." And so the War of Vengeance kind of ends. The War of Conquest is going on. And they decide that they're going to give space. So they do leave, but they only go out beyond 9 waves. But of course, you know, once they're out beyond the 9 waves, once they're no longer in Ireland, the two of the Danann defend themselves. They kind of protect the land and they cast the spells against them so that these kind of waves wash out and the mists come in, the winds blow them out. So anytime the ships of the Sons of Mil try and come back to Ireland after the 3 days, it won't work. They're not going anywhere. Like, the power is cast against them. And so they're all tossed on the sea and they're all beginning to panic and worry. And so they call upon Amrigan. They say, "Okay, well, you know, we need something done. We need these storms kind of stopped and cast down." And so Amrigan then steps up. And what follows in the story is this really long poem. It's a really lovely poem. It kind of breaks it right the way down. It gives a lovely, again, description of Ireland. But I've taken some segments of it here. Because Amrigan kind of stands up and uses his power of words to define reality. And the segment I've taken here is, "I seek the land of Ireland. The high ship Eru, Eru lofty, very green, an incantation very cunning, the great cunning of the wives of Bresh, the wives of Buande, the mighty lady Eru, Eremon harried her." So in this entire poem, Amrigan kind of composes it straight off and kind of calls in his power through it. And he mentions Eru's name. He mentions her name multiple times in order to kind of pull in the sovereignty goddess that he has made his agreements with within Ireland. And then that casts down the storm. So that undoes the two of the Danann's defense, because he has had this connection to Eru. But Eru, again, Eremon harried her. Eremon is actually one of the other Sons of Mil, much like Eberdon. So they come into the island. They have a connection with the sovereignty goddess. Eber disrespects said goddess. They then leave the island. The two of the Danann are defending it with their magic. And so Amrigan invokes the sovereignty goddess of the land in order to undo the defenses against them, in order to try and come into the island again. And so the seas calm, the storms pass, Armageddon's kind of power is shown to fruition. But this part is very, very interesting, because what happens next? Said Don, "I shall now," said he, "put under the edge of spear and sword all that are in Ireland." And the wind rose against that ship, wherein Don and Eric, two sons of Mill, and the ship wherein were Bress, Buas, and Bwan, so that they were drowned at the sandhills of Chac Duin. So, this is great, because to me it shows Eru's prophecy being fulfilled. Armageddon cites her name. He kind of pulls in the power that he has agreed with her by agreeing to name the land in her name, because it's still Era to this day, named for Eru. And she's like, okay, well, you know, we have an agreement. The island was always going to be yours. Come on in. But then Eber Don, who had dissed Eru and said, listen, no, we're not going to give you praise. We're not going to give you thanks. He's like, I'm just going to murder everybody. His intent is to lay everyone under the spear, edge of spear and sword. And so those storms and those winds cast up again, not against the entire fleet, just against one ship. And those ships are wrecked. And those all drown. And so these other kind of characters involved, Eric and stuff, are of Eber's progeny. You know, so Eru's prophecy comes true, because Eber Don will have no bounty of Ireland, and neither will his offspring, and neither will his progeny. So he is drowned. And so the sons of Mil return. They return into Ireland, and the Tuatha Dé Danann can't stop against them. You know, the prophecy has been said, the land Eru has spoken, and so they take ownership, they take over. And what happens is that in the taking ownership of the island, they drive the Tuatha Dé Danann out. And it's said that the Tuatha Dé Danann, under Manon and MacLir, actually, in some of the stories, are transitioned. They move into the Hollow Hills, and they take over rulership of the Sidhe, which is kind of the fairy folk, or believed to be the fairy folk of Ireland. And that's kind of the ending of the Tuatha Dé Danann, and that's the transfer of the power. But it's not all peaceful, because there was contention between the sons of Mil concerning the kingship, that is, between Eber and Ehriman, and Armageddon was brought in to arbitrate between them. And he said, the heritage of the chief of Don of the second Ehriman, and his heritage to Eber after him, but Eher would not accept that, only a division of Ireland. So essentially the sons of Mil come in, and like, they're okay, well, what's the decision? And it goes to Armageddon again. Like, they've called upon him to give right judgment about them staying in Ireland or leaving Ireland. They call upon him again, and he's like, okay, well, actually, this is the lineage, because he knows the lineage. He's a poet. He knows the descendancy. He knows kind of who's who and what's what. He said, okay, well, this is how it should go. But then, like, you know, Eher's like, no, I don't want that. I want it to split. I want a section of the island. I want my own peace. And so the sons of Mil, having unified to come in and take over Ireland, then sunder and tear each other apart to kind of take a part of Ireland. And in the end, there were 6 chieftains southward and 7 chieftains northward who came there, and Eber had the kingship southward and Ehriman had the kingship northward. So they take the island apart between them. I'm sorry, I've gone and kind of stopped my presentation. So one moment. There we go. So yeah, the sons of Mil kind of come through, and they kind of aren't in peace. They aren't in kind of continuity. There's no kind of sharing of the land. They literally just tear it apart themselves so that each can have the peace that they want. And so what happens next after that is the people of the Hollow Hills withheld that which comes from beneath, and grain wouldn't grow nor milk would flow in Ireland, and it was a wasteland. So this is a very, very important part, because again, the Tuatha Dé Danann are moved into the Hollow Hills. They become the people of the Hollow Hills. And in all of the traditions within Ireland, that when you have right rule, when you have a proper connection to sovereignty, a proper connection between the people of the land, the ruler of the land specifically, and the sovereignty of that land, then everything will be abundant. Now, if we remember how, you know, Ith described the Ireland at the start of the section, And then how Amargan describes it when he sets foot upon it, a fishful sea, a bountiful land, you know, not too hot, not too cold, like, you know, wheat in the fields. Like, it's described as an abundant paradise, really, which is why the War of Vengeance for Ith became a war of conquest when the Sons of Mil saw the bounty of Ireland. But they come in, they take over, they disrespect the sovereignty of the land directly. They then tear the land and the arrangements apart themselves because everyone wants their own part, dividing it all up. And the land becomes a wasteland. You know, there is no rightness, there is no balance. So they go to the one person that they know who can do something about it, which is Amargan. Again, this power, this individual with the power of words, the person who can control and understand reality with the divisions of things. And he goes in to resolve it. And resolution was only reached when they made friends with the land's gods of abundance, the god who once ruled as the king and whose grandsons they had overthrown. A figure, it could be said, through which right rule is established and the land preserved against desolation. So the stories that we have shows that Ireland becomes a wasteland. It's not going well. There is no bounty. And so Amargan is sent to kind of make communication with the people in the Hollow Hills, you know, to try and find this balance, to try and move them back towards it. And the person that they have to talk to is the Dagda. Now, the Dagda ruled Ireland. It's said that he ruled Ireland for 80 years as a king, you know, after Lew, I believe it was. His son, Beauharnach, then took over after him. And his grandsons are the rulers of the island at the time that the Sons of Mil arrive. So there still seems to be this Dagda influence right the way through, but it's only when Amargan comes and kind of made friends with the Dagda, and that's the kind of terminology I came across in the stories, that right rule is reestablished. That, like, the proper balance between the other world and this world, between sovereignty of the land and the spirits of the people, are balanced, and then things begin to grow and milk begins to flow again. So this is a heavy kind of segment, you know. I'm just going to pull in those takeaway points again. So the Sons of Mil kind of gathered a host to invade Ireland in pursuit of revenge for Ith. So it's a war of vengeance. Their first intent wasn't coming home. It was invasion. It was straight up kind of, nope, we have to go and avenge. When they kind of arrived, they saw the abundance of it, and their war of vengeance became a war of conquest because they wanted Ireland at that point. They ignored and ridiculed the spirit of sovereignty when she told them that it would be theirs. So there was also a conversation with Fotla, which was the third one. And actually the Eru, Fotla, and Bamba are in another segment of the story. I didn't include it in this because it was different kind of variances. They're actually said to be the wives of the three kings, Macain, Macaigh, and Macrenn. You know, and so there was this ancient like ritual where a king, when they were crowned, would have to have a relationship with the goddess or a sovereignty goddess of the land to ensure that rightness and to ensure that balance. So whether they were actually individuals who were, you know, manifest and, you know, actual partners and actually queens, or were they actually spirits of the land, I'm taking it from the point of view of spirits and sovereignty in this because of the nature of what actually happens in the story. But again, they take on board and they use the power of Eru's name whilst also disrespecting that, you know? And so there's not a real balance there. So decision is made to leave. They went out beyond Nine Waves. They use the power of Eru to kind of allow them to come back in to dominate the land again, but they threaten full on slaughter. You know, they full on say, okay, well, it's not coming home here. It's not kind of coming back. They're actually going to eradicate the people of the land. And so the battles are fierce. They do defeat because their ascendancy is prophesized. You know, they are this invading army that's come all the way through, and they take Ireland. But when the conquest is complete, they send the other people away. They drive the two of them down. There's no living together. There's no kind of arrangement of kind of coexistence. It's literally just, no, we're in charge. You get out. You get gone. But it doesn't kind of get them anything at the end. And it does become that terrible wasteland, which they then have to balance. So that's our view on the Sons of Mil. At this point, it's going to take us to an end of that segment. There probably is little bit left to go around the talks. There's kind of two more segments just to get through. Any quick questions at this point? As I said, it's very, very heavy story-wise. A lot of information to kind of go through. But if anyone had any questions just on that, do fire them into the chat there. And then we'll look into our next section, which is just a quick comparative. Hopefully we shouldn't have it too much over time. And then we can have a bit of Q&A at the end there. So if you want to fire any questions, quick questions in the chat. Okay. So thanks very much, Austrina there. I must have misread history. I thought it was the Sons of Mill that had made the deal about dividing Ireland in half. They chose the top half. Oh, yeah. No, that's part of it. I didn't want to get into that too much in this presentation, but what the story kind of goes is that this agreement or this arrangement kind of happens at the end of the war. And so it's Amargin again with his power of words and kind of comes to the arrangement. Okay, well, the two of the Danann have lost. You know, it's game over for them. And they acknowledge that, like, you know, they're not going to win this against this invading army. And so they try and kind of come to a deal and say, okay, well, can we coexist? Can we have some agreement? And it's said that the Druids of the Sons of Mill and I think it's Amargin as well. I'm not 100% sure on his name as being the linchpin in this, but it does seem like his kind of word manipulation, shall we say, because it's said that the Milesians, the Sons of Mill, would have the top half of the island and the two of the Danann would have the bottom half. And so the conversation there was that the intent may be that, you know, the north and the south, the upper half and the bottom half. But when the two of them agreed to that, that's when the words were shifted on them. And that's where it was twisted because of the powers of the Milesians turned the top, as in everything above ground, and the bottom half that the two of the Danann got was everything below ground. And it was that kind of linchpin thing that drove the two of the Danann into the Hollow Hills because they had to go below ground. Okay, so my understanding from the stories is that, you know, again, our ancient ancestors, the Milesians, kind of by this trickery, by this manipulation of things, didn't split the island fairly, but they did split it evenly in that they got the reality and they drove the two of them into the underground, into the Sidhe, as it were, in the Hollow Hills. And it's that kind of manipulation of intent. It's that kind of alteration of what is kind of, it's equitable, but it might not be fair that leads to this twisting because the two of the Danann now own everything that's underneath the ground. And where does grass grow from? From underneath the ground. Where does wheat grow from? From underneath the ground. And so it's that kind of withdrawing of the sustenance, withdrawing of like the energy or the life or the nutrients that would allow things to grow above the ground that leads to Ireland being a wasteland. You know, so all of that abundance and all of that kind of great stuff that was shown before is lost because it's being withheld below the ground by people who were pushed below the ground by a twisting of the words. And so when Amargin is kind of sent to resolve it, he has to go and make this arrangement or make friends with the Dagda, like the term is to make friends with the Dagda. And it's only then that balance is restored and what flows from below the ground back into above ground. So that's where the halves come. Known in relation to Monaghan and the mist creating the Hollow Hills. Yeah, so Monaghan is, at the time, Monaghan is kind of ascendant figure who kind of comes back from the other world. He's known as a guide in the other world. So he kind of is the one who comes to lead the two of the Danann into the Hollow Hills to kind of take them through, which in essence is they're kind of leaving reality and moving into the other world and moving into the Sailella, the other life, and beyond the mists, as it would be. So I hope that answers the question for you. Okay. If there is any follow-up, we can kind of keep it towards the end and we'll just drive on into this last section. So what we've covered is the lore, is the background story, is the information. So, as I said, Battle of Moytura as source text, the Laragabala era, and specifically around the Tuatha'an and the Firbolg and the Fomorians. Sorry, the Sons of Mil and the Tuatha'Danann being the main things, because we're looking at this intent. We're looking at, you know, what is the flow here? Like, how are they coming? How are they approaching to their taking of Ireland? Okay, so we're going to have just a quick side-by-side between them. So descendant or colonizer. And the use of the word colonizer is very much with intent here, because Ireland, whatever it is about my island or my country, the land in which I live, it's always been a source of intent, various intents for anyone who comes here. There's something about the connections, there's something about the land, there's something about, you know, where it is, how it is, that kind of captures people, you know. And I think this is what has happened with these ancient stories. So, the Tuatha'Danann first, their intent is a homecoming, you know, straight up, like, you know, their intent, you know, their hearts were filled with happiness that they had come home to Ireland, the land of their origin. Okay, and in their homecoming, they requested a share of the land. They approached those who were here, the Firbolg, and like, listen, can we have equitable share? Can we have half the land for our people to live with your people? You know, they acknowledged the shared language and the shared bloodline. So their first interaction, warrior to warrior, champion to champion, was, oh yeah, yeah, your great 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 granddad was my great great granddad's brother. You know, it's kind of how I imagine it paraphrased in my head. But they acknowledged the shared language, that we are of the same root, we're of the same kind of people here, like, you know, so can we have a balanced share when we come to this land of our origin? They try and negotiate multiple times. So the Tuatha'Danann is multiple occasions, right then when the two champions meet, again when Nuada sends the poets over to Uchud's court, you know, they're like, okay, well listen, can we just not have a scrap? Can we kind of have just a place to live? We want to just come home. So it does go to the conflict, but the conflict is not a war of eradication. It's a war of challenge to see who's worthy, to see who should be in control, you know, based on virtue of skill, not based on technical knowledge, because they swap spears for javelins. And not just swap them, they swap the knowledge of spears and javelins. The Tuatha'Danann send their smiths to their Firbolg to make them their spears and to show them how to do it. They don't just give them 10 spears and go, yeah, yeah, that's your lot. There is a cultural exchange of knowledge between these two people. Okay? So it does go to the conflict. The conflict is resolved. As I said, not to the point of eradication. They allow each time to deal with their wounded and to deal with their dead honorably. But at the end of it, they share the space. You know, they agreed for Firbolg, listen, what province do you want? Pick some land. Let's be together on this. You know, let's live with you. You know, and then they pass on living in right balance together with the land and the sovereignty. I had a moment when I was going through developing this and kind of reading through as much information to get to this. One of the other lead characters in the Tuatha'Danann pantheon is Lu. Lu's foster mother is Tailtu. The games and such that he had in his honor for the plains, Tailtu. It was a Firbolg queen. So the Tuatha'Danann lived in peace and balance with the Firbolg after their conflict, but they didn't kind of debase them. They didn't kind of own them. They didn't kind of enslave them. They lived fairly and evenly, and even fostered one of their own kind of great hero champions with someone who's still listed as a queen, someone who held their rights, their ranks, their privileges. So it was a shared equitable circumstance between two peoples who had a conflict, but it was a conflict to resolve a dispute to get to the point of, okay, well, who should be in charge, because we can't agree on who should it be. So the Sons of Mil, they gathered a war host for revenge. Their first intent, they got Ith's body back, which, you know, again, it was returned to them. Yes, there was a, you know, he was killed, but he was sent back to them. Again, respecting the dead and respecting the purposes and processes of that. And so they gathered a war host for revenge. when they came to Ireland, they saw the land and how bounteous it was. Aragorn, again, getting on his boat, put his foot on the island, is like, I am this, I am the roaring ocean, I am the vulture on the cliff, and all of this, declaring who he is. And then he declares, oh, a fishful sea, a great bounteous land. Oh, look at all those woods. Look at that over there. So he then lists off how fantastic the island is. And so things begin to twist from a war of revenge into a war of conquest. They spurn yet invoke the sovereignty of the land. You know, they make all these agreements. They go to the sovereignty goddesses, Fotla, Banva, and Eru. Eru's like, listen, you were always going to win. Let's just be fair. You know, you've invaded your way and conquered your way all across the rest of the continent. You know, all across the way as far as Spain. It was going to happen that you came here and you're going to win. That's okay. And then they disrespect it straight away. Like, you know, Eber is like, you know, okay, yeah, well, we're not going to thank you for that. We're going to thank our own gods because we're great. Screw you. At which point, you know, she's like, okay, well, listen, if that's your attitude towards it, if that's your intent, you're going to get no profit here. It's not going to stand to you. And so they then leave Ireland. The druids cast the spells against them. And what does Aragorn do to get them back into Ireland? Invokes the power of the gods, goddess. Invokes Eru's name to come back in. And then they threaten slaughter. They pursue a war of conquest. They're coming back in to take over, which they do. They succeed. They don't then live in harmony. They don't kind of arrange an equitable sharing of the land. They just drive the two of the Danann into the Hollow Hills. They drive the people away from reality in below the ground. And once their conquest is complete, once they've had all of their fights against the people of the land, what do? They fight with each other. They dispute the rule of the land amongst themselves. They end up just tearing it apart and dividing it. Each of them focused on their own gain. So that's the Sons of Mil. That's who we have. So at this point, who seems to be a descendant? Who seems to be a colonizer? So what we kind of draw from this part is just an indication of what intent each tribe had on their view of Ireland. You know, the two of the Danann, their intent was homecoming. You know, they had oppressions out there. The Fomorian issue was still going on for them, and they just really, really wanted to come home to the place that they were descended from. Sons of Mil saw this bounteous land and like, oh, we'll have that. So their intent was not homecoming. Their intent was conquest. You know, one group, as I said, saw it as a cohabitation. They wanted to come home. They wanted to be on this land. And then they succeeded in cohabiting with the indigenous people. You know, they succeeded in sharing space with them. Yes, there was conflict, but conflict was resolved. And then sharing happened. And then there was the culture exchange. And then, you know, they became one peoples together in the land. The other group set out a clear intent to harm. They saw the bounty of Ireland. They saw, like, you know, what was available within the land. And then they just put a claim on it. They just demanded it by conquest. There wasn't any integration. There wasn't any kind of peacemaking. There wasn't any coming together in any way. So, descendant or colonizer. So this is the last section of it. I'm aware we are slightly over time. So what does all of this mean? What was the intent? What was the whole purpose in taking you through all this story? And as I mentioned at the very, very start, the thing that I value most is a good question. I'm not giving you answers. I would not claim to give you answers. I'm giving you information. But to bring us to a close on this, we take a few minutes to look at the questions of relevance about the information and how that might connect us or how it might help us with our spiritual connectivity when we're dealing with the two gods of the two of the Danann and Ireland. Because we're not descended from the two of the Danann. We're descended from the Sons of Mil. You know, that's what the story would tell us. So, what does any of this mean to me? Now, I can only speak from my own view on it. So, at this point, if there are any questions, do start throwing them into the chat, because I'll go through the few that I have on the screen, and then we'll probably take through some more from your questions on there today, all right? So, what does any of this mean to me? Attitude is important as we approach our tribes dealing with other tribes. Or is attitude important? You know, from my view personally, I think attitude is very important. You know, that intent, irrespective of the impact, your intent is important. Now, as they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. You know, your intentions don't buy you much, but it still counts for something. So if your intention is not right, if your intention is not honest, not in keeping with what is mutual respect, what is equitability, what is kind of fair exchange, you know, what is balance, what is righteousness between your tribe and dealing with their tribe. If you're kind of choosing or looking to communicate with the Tuatha De Danann as deity, you know, what is your intent? What is your attitude to the approach around that? You know, is it transactional? Which is fine, you know. Are you looking for an exchange? Is it a contract? You know, I need something. Can you give something? But just again, what is the attitude around that when you're respecting and dealing with your tribe and their tribe? What awarenesses should we carry when approaching a new land and other tribes? You know, moral of the story from this, you know, coming across into the land, the Tuatha De Danann came home, approaching a new land that was their old land, but they approached the other tribe that was already there. They approached the indigenous people with, can we just live with you? Can we share? What's the fairness here? What can we work on? And they were aware of their connection, their history, aware of their language. They said, listen, okay, well, like, we're of the same. Like, you know, why can't we be as one on this? Whereas the Sons of Mill, on the other hand, didn't have those awarenesses, didn't care about those awarenesses. They saw a land. They saw something that they wanted to take. So how is that important when we're approaching connecting to a land? Like even going to another land, like, you know, I'm not as widely traveled as I would like to be, you know, but whenever I go to a new land, I'll always try and take a minute to connect to the land itself, you know, find a patch of dirt somewhere that's not in the middle of a city or wherever I can and put my feet on it, put my hand on it and kind of just feel what the land is, you know, anywhere I can kind of acknowledge that the people of that land are going to be 100% different to me, but they're still people. You know, they're still people of a different tribe, but they're still people who deserve the respect around those areas. So what value is there being aware of the stories and how they shape our own spirituality? For me, stories hugely shape my spirituality. You know, I started the Dag the Stories years ago, writing them, and that is an exploration of my spirituality. That is an exploration of my seeking the Dagda, trying to find him through the stories, but also then trying to find what that spirituality means to me and what connections to his tribe, to the Tuatha De Danann, means to me. You know, so knowing these ancient stories, knowing what comes has gone before, do I learn from the mistakes? Can I pick up on the moral of the story, the intent involved? You know, what can I learn to shape my own spirituality going forward? It's a constant question that I work with and deal with. You know, as I said, in creating this presentation, I had a really, really good experience with acknowledging, like, you know, Tulchu. I have never had a connection to Tulchu at all. I don't have much of a connection to Lu, but that awareness that she was for Bullock, you know, and still maintained all of her ranks and everything else was huge for me. You know, it's that kind of fact that from that story, I know what integration should be more like, you know, how, yes, there might be conflict. Yes, there might be battles, but that doesn't mean that you're enemy forever. That doesn't mean a battle can't be pursued, a conflict or challenge can't be pursued equitably, honestly, fairly, to reach a resolution. And then the resolution doesn't have to color the rest of your existence. It could be rocking up and knowing Tulchu is absolutely perfect person to foster a young child and raise him up to be a future king of Ireland. So the stories for me have a big important step. In both of these instances, in both of these stories, Uchad has this vision, has this prophecy told to him and clarified by his druid, that the two of the Danann are going to win. They're like, you know, they excel in every skill. You know, we can't go against that and win. And again, Eru kind of tells the Sons of Milda Milesians, you're going to win. You know, knowledge has always been here that you are going to win this. You know, so let just be cool. So what is there best to consider when victory is assured? or welcome is assured. If you know you're going to be going to a place, I've had the privilege of traveling over to like America and to kind of been to a couple of places where, you know, I knew I was welcome. You know, I've done PantheaCon a couple of times and there was a group there, friends of mine over there who I knew I was welcome. But irrespective of how assured I was at the welcome, what was best for me to consider when going into their space? What was best for me to acknowledge of my own challenges, my own biases, as I mentioned earlier on, my own privileges? You know, what is it best to be bringing when welcome or victory is assured? And knowing that the hospitality of is a huge, huge important when dealing specifically with all, well, okay, specifically, with, well, when dealing with all two of the Danann or Irish gods, you know, very more so when dealing with the Dagdu, if hospitality is guaranteed. You know, if you rock up and say, listen, I need hospitality, you're getting hospitality. But what's best for you to be aware of? Like, you know, is there something to acknowledge the role of the guest in that exchange, you know, to carry that forward with you when your victory is assured? I think second last question here, and then we'll dive into yours if that's okay. What is your impact on the tribe you connect with? It's a two-way exchange. You know, as much as I kind of talk about Dagda every day and kind of serve him kind of portions of food, you know, I am impacting on him. And by that, I'm impacting on his tribe. You know, so what is my impact when I connect with him? You know, am I just making it about me? Is it a case of like, okay, well, I want a contractual exchange whereby you deliver abundance to me and I anything or everything? You know, I don't know, you know. From my actual agreement with Dagda is that he looks after people I love and care about. There's a particular thing. I will say his name anytime I speak in front of people like this. And he's looking after people I care about and love, as well as looking after me while I'm saying his work and doing, like saying his name and doing his work. But as much as I'm doing that, I'm also impacting on him. You know, I'm doing my darndest to explore all of these stories and explore the Tuatha Dé Danann in as honest a way as I can. Acknowledging my bias, acknowledging my privilege and my questions around these things, knowing that anytime I talk to you, my audience about this, or anytime I talk to anybody about this, I'm impacting their perspective of that tribe. So what is my impact there? Because I'm responsible for that. And so I got to be very, very careful around that. And so from a spiritual connectivity point of view, it's not a case that you can just, well, in my opinion, we can't just make our expectations and not acknowledge the fact that it is having an impact on a living tradition, a living kind of group, a living kind of deity, you know. And some people say traditions evolve, or like, you know, it's a different kind of view of things, or like, you know, my spirituality is not your spirituality. Absolutely, I get that. But if you're not acknowledging the root that it's coming from, if you're not acknowledging your impact on them or accepting the fact that, you know, some fundamental baselines of their deity, of their story exist irrespective of what you believe of them, then is that a correct impact with your connection? And then the last, I think, yeah, what exchange takes place in your interactions with that tribe? You know, what exchange is back and forward? Like, you know, I give my service and my work, the use of my voice to the Dagda. In exchange for my interaction, he looks after the people I care about, and also he looks after me. You know, as I mentioned previously, there, like, you know, abundance does flow when I'm doing the work. You know, all of you being here this evening is proof of that, and I really, really appreciate every single one of you. You know, I would not be able to be here doing these things if not for you. So this is the interaction. You know, I'm interacting with you as my tribe, and I'm interacting on behalf of him. So hopefully I'm bringing a more awareness to the Tuatha Dé Danann as a tribe. Okay? So, oh yeah, why is intent as important as your actions? I don't think I'll answer that one. I think I'll leave that one for you guys. Why is your intent as important as your actions? So that takes us to the end of the presentation. And I'd like to thank you very, very much for joining me today. So we're going to take a quick Well, hopefully it's quick. As I said, I know I'm run over. A couple of questions have popped up in the chat, and I'm delighted that there is such engagement. Ted Lloyd, so many more questions about how these ancient stories are still with us today on so many levels. Is there a lesson for us today towards achieving balance, a united Ireland, reconciliation, peace? Thank you, Ted. I love it. I absolutely love it. You know, I will never claim that I can answer any question at all, but I will give you a perspective on my questions. But this, like, having a question is a journey. You know, I'm a storyteller. That's what I do. I write stories, and every story starts with a question. You know, what if, how can we, where do we go? You know, and having those questions and having the bravery to seek answers to those questions, that to me is a spiritual path. So absolutely, we kind of need to give props to the Christian monks. You know, if it wasn't for the fact that there was such a dedication to writing those stories down. And in fact, a lot of the stories when they're written down as filler. Yeah, a lot of the ancient manuscripts are these kind of huge illuminated tomes where they're writing in the stories of each monastery. They're writing in, like, you know, their own kind of, you know, information around, like, you know, well, the history, the longevity, like, you know, the Christianity of that monastery. But then, like, in order to kind of fill gaps, they kind of got the local knowledge, and I would just shove a story in there. It's like, you know, here's a short story to break up the monotony of talking about the monastery and how it was established. But then, because of all these different books, we have these little segments of these kind of short stories in between, these oral traditions carried on, and that's how they've survived down. Now, there's a lot of kind of work been done through the Celtic revivalist periods and early 1900s, maybe. Don't quote me on that. But yeah, a lot of the translations then coming through, and there's still new translations happening all the time. Morgan Daimler, they do absolutely great work kind of going back into it. Isolde Bullock on Carmody of Story Archaeology is doing translations of these ancient stuff as well to kind of help us through, because some of the older kind of translations were, I mentioned at the start of my presentation, biased through my bias around this information. I'm looking at it through the lens of an Irish person raised in modern Ireland with my ancient folklore. A lot of the early translations weren't done by Irish people, you know, and they were done by early Victorian or Edwardian, I don't know, the monarchical segments, right ways in history. But they were done through the lens of propriety in the early 1900s, you know, 1920, 1930s. And there was actually, I think it was Gray's like translation of some of the early stories. She was of her time, and there were segments of it where she's doing all of her translations, and there's a big segment that she didn't translate because it dealt with the Dagda's sexuality, as far as I know, or just like serious descriptions of his physical form in a sexual sense. You know, but that was, no, couldn't translate that, you know. So there's a lot of kind of stuff that we have, but I think, you know, we need to kind of have more effort going back and doing what we can around viewing this, because it's a huge resource, and it can have such a very strong, impactful alteration to a life, as it has with mine. So that's what I'd say. United Ireland. Let's talk about that one another time. Balance, achieving balance and rightness, you know, capital R rightness, you know, being right, not correct, not like, you know, always correct, but it's being right, being morally right, being in the right kind of position. That is a job of a lifetime, and it's one I'm working on, and I think it's something worth chasing. So Alice, Drania, Alex there, didn't realize how connected the tribes were as descendants of Nemed. Yep. Each wave returning to Ireland, I realized that we are actually descended from the sons of Mil, but in reality, there's a greater connection between all of the tribes, all of the invasions, and our own connection to those stories in a grand scheme of things. We are the same, even though we are convinced of our differences. Yeah. I'm really glad that came across, because that was something that really kind of hit home for me. Ireland, going back to kind of Ted's mention earlier on, like early civilization, origins of civilization in Ireland, they were one people. They were one tribe. And they're referred to as the children of Nemed, and they kind of took their small segments of the families that they could flee from the Fomorians and went out. You know? And so as much as we have the Sons of Mil as this invading army coming up out of the Middle East and all the way across, ending up in Spain, you know, we still had all the, like, the Firbolg went down and ended up in Greece. You know, it says that the Tuatha went up, and they went up and around the north area. We don't exactly know where their great cities were. But when they left to come back, they didn't come straight back to Ireland. They actually are roaming around to kind of learn occult and mystic knowledge from all over to kind of raise the ability of their people so that they could be the best people they could be. And maybe that's why they're more deity than Firbolgs or Sons of Mil as we go. But yeah, like, we're all human. That's a fundamental statement, but it's a powerful statement. And we're divided as a species across so many different ways, you know, different lands, different cultures, different everything. And people kind of find reasons to divide, where in my humble idealistic approach, opinion, we should be looking for reasons to unify. So yeah, Lan, thank you very much. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you very much indeed. Yeah, well, we are coming up on 11 o'clock at this point, so I will say thank you very, very much for joining me for this. Alex, amazing questions, very thought-provoking. I could continue discussing this all night. Is there a place for ongoing discussion on the questions derived from this course? I love it. Yep. Okay. So yeah, we'll come to a wrap it up to a close. Thank you very, very, very much for joining me. I do really, really appreciate your presence. This kind of course is on the Irish Pagan School. There is a Facebook group, Irish Pagan School, in group there. So, you know, I started the event there. Maybe you can pop in and kind of say, okay, we're taking of Ireland, and kind of throw questions there. I will kind of keep an eye on that over the next few days to kind of see if there's more that we could be discussing around it. Anyone who can, write a review if you feel, because that would really, really help with this. All of this work, as I said at the very start, is to try and, you know, bring together as much Irish pagan knowledge as we can to kind of give a space to connect people with the knowledge and with the traditions, you know, not just my own work, as I said, like, you know, I'm delighted and privileged to be able to present here, but there are other kind of Irish people that we're working on getting into the schedule as well. And so reviews always absolutely help. Share the events. Irish Pagan Group is probably best. I think Laura may have, yeah, no, Laura definitely set up the group on there. And I think probably publicly on Facebook might be the best way to answer it, because then if there's any kind of crossover on questions, they're answered for everybody, instead of me answering individual emails or anything like that at all. Okay. So I'd like to say thank you very much. Gurav Mila Mahagat. And I'll slán for now.